This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's gay and lesbian community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. More information at 503-230-7701 or pdxgayyellowpages.com.
It's 9:33. You're listening to Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is KBOO Portland. I love the days after Valentine's because I can buy a big box of chocolates for myself on the cheap. Long live Brigid Juno Februaria, comma, Eros and Priapus, that rascally guy Priapus. Io Priapus. Those would be the guys that were celebrated with sexual games. Before the church started with its myth about St. Valentine's, who never existed. Well, I've been thinking about the list of complaints for impeachment. And, you know, it's kind of hard to know where to start, so I'll just start anywhere. How about war on weapons of mass destruction claims? The lie. The war on the lie. The dead, the horror. That'll do. That's enough. But then there's Blamegate. Then there's failing on global warming, which is malfeasance if I ever heard of it. Global malfeasance. Wonderful. I mean, failing on global warming, I guess it's the equivalent of if the U.S. had just kind of got sloppy during the Cold War and let off a couple of nukes. It'll get worse and worse. Then there's the evident collaboration with 911. And there's the fascist spying and the false imprisonment, the torture and rendition that has come to define what it is to be an American. And there's failing on Katrina, evidently with malice aforethought. We all know just how slow and how little and how strange and how trickly the aid was coming into victims of Katrina and how people were turned away and how donations from other nations were turned away. But I'd like to give you a bit of history just as contrast. In the great San Francisco earthquake, a commander of the army, not a commander, but I think he was a general or something or other type of general, telegraphed Washington from the first telegraph line he could find working outside town. And the first train dispatched from telegraph signals from Washington, I'm not sure where it originated, arrived in San Francisco at 11 p.m. that night. Imagine that. 11 p.m. that night, a trainload of supplies. And that was at the turn of the 20th century. Imagine what the U.S. could have done to aid Katrina victims. Let's move forward to 1948. Soviet authorities, claiming technical difficulties, halted all traffic by land and by water into or out of the Western-controlled section of Berlin. The only remaining access routes into the city were three 20-mile-wide air corridors across the Russian zone of Germany. Faced with the choice of abandoning the city or attempting to supply its inhabitants with the necessities of life by air, the Western powers chose the latter course and for the next 11 months sustained the city's 2.5 million residents in one of the greatest feats in aviation history. Operation Vittles, as the airlift was officially named, began on June 26, when U.S. Air Force C-47s carried 80 tons of food into Berlin. This force was soon augmented by U.S. Navy and Royal Air Force cargo aircraft. On October 15, 1948, the Allies created a unified command, the Combined Airlift Task Force, and they just kept those planes flying in there. They had to coordinate them specially. They were coming in so constantly that if you missed your first touch on the airstrip, you were supposed to circle all the way back to your starting point. And that's what the U.S. can do, unless they want you to die. Well, what an interesting week it's been. That's from John Nichols in The Nation. Vice President Dick Cheney, who was forced to leave Yale University because his penchant for late-night beer drinking exceeded his devotion to his studies, and who is one of the small number of Americans who can count two drunk driving busts on his records, on his record, that is, was doing more than hunting quail on the day that he shot a Texas lawyer in the face. The vice president has admitted he was drinking on the afternoon of the incident. He claims it was only a beer, according to the transcript of an interview with Fox News Wednesday, faux news, I mean. But the whole discussion about how much drinking took place on the day of the fateful hunt has been evolving rapidly since Catherine Armstrong, the wealthy Republican lobbyist who is a member of the politically connected family that owns the ranch, where Cheney blasted his hunting partner, initially claimed that no one was imbibing before the incident. That's from John Nichols in The Nation. And then there was the strange disappearance of the beer mentioned from the news. Won't get into that right now. But here's something from CNN. Armstrong, Catherine Armstrong that I just mentioned, had previously told CNN that she never saw Cheney or Whittington drink at all on the day of the shooting until after the accident occurred when, get this, the vice president fixed himself a cocktail back at the house. So, okay, only a beer at lunch. Blast your hunting partner in the face, chest, heart, neck. Fix yourself a cocktail afterwards. You think somebody might have a drinking problem? I mean, Lord knows I love to tie one on myself, but I don't go around with a shotgun when I'm doing it. And by the way, it's a tiny point, but the shotgun that Cheney was using is the same one that the macho posers, it's the same type of gun that the macho posers said was a feat when it was in the hands of John Kerry. The Republican macho posers, including Drugs Limbaugh, as long as we're getting into hypocrisy. TheSmokingGun.com says court and police records obtained by the Smoking Gun show that Cheney was convicted of drunk driving twice during an eight-month period in the early 60s in his home state of Wyoming. The two convictions came when Cheney was 21 and 22 and resulted in fines and a brief suspension of his driver's license. Be a bit more now, wouldn't it? From Reuters, Vice President Dick Cheney said on Wednesday he may be called as a witness. Oh, here's the real news. In the case of his former aide, Louis Scooter Libby, who faces perjury and other charges in the leak of a CIA operative's identity. Cheney refused to comment on reports that he directed Libby to use classified material to discredit a critic of the Bush administration's Iraq war effort, saying, "It's nothing I could talk about." Quote, "I've cooperated fully, including being interviewed as well by a special prosecutor," Cheney said in an interview on Faux News Channel. "I may well be called as a witness at some point in the case, and it's therefore inappropriate for me to comment on any facet of the case," end quote. Court papers released last week show that Libby was authorized to disclose classified information to news reporters by his superiors. That would be Cheney. Ain't no other superiors. He's chief of staff for Cheney. In an effort to counteract diplomat Joe Wilson's charge that the Bush administration twisted intelligence on Iraq's nuclear programs to justify the 2003 invasion. The National Journal, citing attorneys familiar with the matter, reported that Cheney was among those superiors referred to in a letter from prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald to Libby's lawyers. Cheney's name has surfaced in other court documents as well. According to an appeals court decision made public this month, the vice president informed Libby in an off sort of curiosity sort of fashion, that's a quotation, that Wilson's wife worked at the CIA 1 month before her identity was made public. Off sort of curiosity sort of fashion, you know, like, "Oh, by the way, my pet viper, I've left a live hamster in your cage, just in case you're a bit curious, you know, being a viper and hamsters being, oh, well, I've got a meeting, see you later." Yeah, right. Time is 9:42, and you're listening to KBOO's Press Watch, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. From the San Francisco Bay View, a quote from Henry Kissinger. Good old Henry said once, "Military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns in foreign policy," end quote. Of course, he did not say it like that. Military men are just dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns in foreign policy. Ah. So, with that quote, the American Free Press dropped a dirty bomb on the Pentagon by reporting that 8 out of the 20 men who served in one unit in the 2003 U.S. military offensive in Iraq now have malignancies. That means that 40% of the soldiers in that unit have developed malignancies in just 16 months, 40% with cancer. And, of course, you know what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about depleted uranium. This information is from the San Francisco Bay View. Since these soldiers were exposed to vaccines and depleted uranium only, this is strong evidence for researchers and scientists working on this issue that DU is the definitive cause of Gulf War syndrome. Vaccines are not known to cause cancer. One of the first public researchers on Gulf War syndrome, who also served in 91 in Iraq, Dr. Andres Korayan-Boff, is in agreement with Barbara Goodnow from the Department of Defense Deployment Health Support Directorate that in this war, soldiers were not exposed to chemicals, pesticides, bioagents, or other suspect causes this time to confuse the issue. This powerful new evidence is blowing holes in the cover-up perpetrated by the Pentagon in three presidential administrations ever since DU was first used in 91 in the Persian Gulf War. 14 years after the introduction of depleted uranium on the battlefield in 91, the long-term effects have revealed that DU is a death sentence. This from healthnow.org. Recently completed laboratory analyses show two members of Uranium Medical Research Center's field investigation are contaminated with depleted uranium. Now, these are field staff, one from Canada and the other from Beirut. They toured Iraq for 13 days. They did not fight. They toured Iraq for 13 days, and they're contaminated. 5 months after the cessation of Operation Iraqi Freedom's aerial bombing and ground force campaign using mass spectrometry, UMRC's partner laboratory in Germany measured DU in both team members' urine samples. The team surveyed U.S. and British-controlled combat areas and bomb sites in southern Iraq, including Baghdad and three other cities, including Basra. The conditions responsible for the team's DU contamination are considered to be inhalation of resuspended ultrafine soil and dust particles saturated with uranium and airborne uranium oxides and metallic particulate. Uranium was used in anti-tank penetrators, suppression ordnance, and bunker defeat warheads deployed during the 26 days of Operation Iraqi Freedom by both U.S. and U.K. forces. The contamination of UMRC's team members occurring over a two-week period many months after the main conflict represents a risk to civilians, non-governmental organizations, staff, coalition armed forces, of course, and foreign contractors and diplomatic staff. It would appear virtually everyone who regularly passes through a contaminated area will be exposed. The more one passes through, the more serious the exposure. How bad is the exposure? Virtually every source with culpability or funding from a culpable source, like the U.S. government, denies there is any issue. World Health Organization receives much of its funding from the U.S. It's likely that its money is contingent on its work. Their view is that damage from exposure to DU is rare and requires incredibly high concentrations in the blood. If that's true, though, why would the Manhattan Project consider DU as a weapon of mass destruction? The blueprint for depleted uranium weapons is a 1943 declassified document from the Manhattan Project. That was a project that developed the atomic bomb. Harvard president and physicist James Conant, who developed poison gas in World War I, was brought into the Manhattan Project by a father of presidential candidate John Kerry. Funny how those old families all get mixed up into stuff, huh? Kerry's father served at a high level in the Manhattan Project and was a CIA agent. Of course, that would be after the war, since the CIA was formed in 47. Conant was chair of the S-1 Poison Gas Committee, which recommended developing poison gas weapons from the radioactive trash of the atomic bomb project in World War II. At that time, it was known that radioactive materials dispersed in bombs from the air, from land vehicles, or on the battlefield produced very fine radioactive dust which would penetrate all protective clothing, any gas mask or filter, or the skin. By contaminating the lungs and blood, it could kill or cause illness very quickly. They also recommended it as a, get this, permanent terrain contaminant, which could be used to destroy populations, that's genocide, by contaminating water supplies and agricultural land with radioactive dust. The Defense Department is very well aware of the toxic effects of depleted uranium. An official presentation by U.S. Army Reserve Colonel Wakayama in Virginia on August 20, 2002, the dangers of exposure to DU were clearly spelled out. Inhalation exposure has a major effect on the lungs and thoracic lymph nodes. Wakayama read from a slide, the alpha particle taken inside the body in large doses is hazardous, producing cell damage and cancer. Lung cancer is well documented, he noted. Urine samples containing uranium are mutagenic, that is, capable of producing mutation, and the cultured human stem bone cell line with depleted uranium was also transformed, the cells to become carcinogenic. DU deposited in bone causes DNA damage because of the effects of the alpha particles. 1 gram of DU emits 12,000 high-energy alpha particles per second. I want to edit this a bit on the air. When they say high-energy alpha particles, remember that alpha particles can be stopped by a sheet of paper. And the reason that they cause so much cancer when they're inside the body is because rather than creating enough damage to cause a cyst, they just keep ticking away at the chromosomes. The fourth rule for weapons, the environmental test, says that weapons cannot have an unduly negative effect on natural on the natural environment. Dr. Wakayama advised heavily contaminated soil should be removed if the area is to be populated with civilians. And he described the dangers to children playing in contaminated soil. You can see some of the children if you look online and see what happens to kids who are born in areas where there is depleted uranium. I could describe it on the air, but it would make you rather sick. Why would the U.S. use such a dangerous munition? Many authors have speculated about deliberate genocide of the Arab and Serbian populations. And departing from that text, I would agree. This is a genocidal weapon. It is creating a genocide. It is intended for genocide. It has certain effects. The author points out that most of the people in the Bush administration have a suspicion of the research in contamination. They point to the overwhelming exposures to rats as a method of research. But it has a little common sense value. Environmental research is perceived as conducted by socialist tree huggers who have a vested interest in tainting and exaggerating the research so that they can bring down the government, steal from the rich, and give to the undeserving, lazy, poor. And the people who really, really know about this stuff are evidently genocidalists. And so it's that intelligentsia, that elite, that I accuse of genocide, and the genocide's going on. And when you've got people ignorant of your vicious plans, then that can be very handy. And so I bring this to light not just because it's so serious and the stuff is spreading across the globe. I mean, these soldiers come here. They're contaminating people, they're contaminating their family, their equipment is contaminating other people, their bodies when cremated contaminate an entire area. This, at this point, this is far more serious than bird flu. This is a health threat brought to you by the Bush administration. You're listening to Press Watch, and coming up, we are going to have Chico Mismo sobre cosas cultural y mucho más. What's going on, and that'll be the first time we broadcast that, and that'll be followed by Julia Bernard, the brains behind the art. Coming up on Democracy Now! At 11 o'clock, headlines, there will be the Rene Préval wins the Haitian election, UN investigators calling U.S. to close Guantanamo, Iraqis outraged over new Abu Ghraib photos, also sickening to view, I just looked at them this morning. The U.S. government criticizes the release of the new photographs, isn't that typical of the Bush administration. The U.S. denies entry to Iraqi widows. And let's see, there will also be a discussion of Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney blasting the government for creating a new underclass of Katrina homeless. And a story about the FEMA failing Katrina evacuees on housing. The hotel evictions continue, and the promises of trailers and rental assistance are unmet. Hey, where's the airlift? So I'll be coming up on Democracy Now!, which makes it a really hot morning here, even though it's a cold day on KBOO, so I think that you'll want to stay tuned. 9:52, a little history again. 1839, the British invade Afghanistan. There was some resistance, but the Emir, Dost Muhammad Khan, surrendered to the British, and he was deported to India. British declared victory. And Shah Shuja was installed as a puppet king by the British. He was in there from 1839 to 1842 when he was killed by the Afghans. And suddenly, Afghans started popping up all over the place. seemingly from everywhere, with weapons, very well coordinated, very determined. And Akbar Khan, who is leading them, was victorious against the British. How victorious was he? Well, there were 16,500 soldiers in the field outside Jalalabad. Of the 16,500 soldiers and their 12,000 dependents, after Akbar Khan attacked, one survivor of mixed British-Indian garrison reached the fort in Jalalabad on a stumbling pony. That would be one survivor to tell the tale. So that brings us up to the present from the Independent in UK, with the army in a new abuse scandal and no exit strategy from Iraq in sight. UK troops are headed into another war zone. Suicide bombings and firefights. Western troops under attack. Sectarian clashes between Shia and Sunni. Foreigners taken hostage. Days of escalating violence have left dozens of people dead and more than 100 injured. This is not Iraq, but Afghanistan. A conflict which is now overtaken on the grim league table of body counts. 89 killings in the last 8 days in Afghanistan compared to 54 in Iraq during the same period. It is into this maelstrom that the Royal Marines, the first batch of 5,700 British troops being sent to Afghanistan, will begin deploying this week in a mission lasting at least 3 years at a cost of £1 billion. History is mighty interesting, don't you think? The Jakarta Post, Jakarta says, with more human cases of bird flu being reported into the country, ministers warn the virus may be mutating into a more virulent form that is capable of being transmitted from human to human. The amount of time between contracting the virus and death is becoming shorter, raising the possibility the virus is becoming more virulent. Agriculture Minister Anton Aprijantano said Wednesday before a limited cabinet meeting with governors from five provinces to discuss efforts to combat bird flu. The meeting comes at a time of increased criticism over the government's perceived failure to respond to the crisis with the necessary speed or force. Of the 26 people who have tested positive for the H5N1 form of the avian influenza virus since last year at the World Health Organization accredited laboratory in Hong Kong, 18 have died. Eight of these cases have occurred this year with seven fatalities. Most of the victims raised poultry or lived in areas where poultry was common. Indonesia has reported the second highest number of human bird flu cases in the world and has suffered the second highest number of fatalities. The health minister there said the country had experienced the highest number of bird flu cluster fatalities, which involved the infection of people living near one another. There have been six cluster fatalities reported there. The more cluster fatalities, the greater possibility for the virus to mutate into a form that can be easily transmitted among humans. The key word there, easily transmitted among humans, triggering a pandemic. So there's that. And then, just to make things more interesting, it would appear that the Pentagon intends to have a 100-year war. And there's more on that from The Guardian. Looking beyond Iraq and Afghan battlefields, U.S. commanders envisage a war unlimited in time and space against the global Islamist extremism. The struggle may be fought in dozens of other countries simultaneously, and for many years to come, the report says. The emphasis switches from... Thanks to Daniel and Michael for bringing this to my attention. The emphasis switches from large-scale conventional military operations, such as the 2003 invasion of Iraq, towards a rapid deployment of highly mobile, often covert counter-terrorist forces. Terrorists would be anyone on the other side of your gun, apparently, if you look at U.S. history and habits. But anyway, amongst specific measures proposed are, according to The Guardian, an increase of special operations forces by 15%. Next to 3,700 personnel and psychological operations and civil affairs units, an increase of 33%, nearly double the number of unmanned aerial drones. The conversion of submarine-launched Trident nuclear missiles for use in conventional strikes, new close-to-shore high-speed naval capabilities, special teams trained to detect and render safe nuclear weapons anywhere in the world, and a new long-range bomber force. Now, isn't that fun? The Pentagon does not pinpoint the countries it sees as future areas of operations, but they will stretch beyond the Middle East to the Horn of Africa, North Africa, Central and Southeast Asia, and the Northern Caucasus. The Cold War dominated the world from 46 to 91. The Long War, as they're calling it, could determine the shape of the world for decades to come. The plan rests heavily on much higher level of cooperation and integration with Britain and other NATO allies, and the increased recruitment of regional governments through the use of economic, political, military and security means, read intimidation. It calls on allies to build their capacity to share the risks and responsibilities of today's complex challenges. Isn't it wonderful how they phrase things? Today's complex challenges, building their capacity. We're talking about a 100 years war. They're completely nuts. absolutely freaking cuckoo nuts. So, that means that I will be talking more about resistance, and particularly April 29th. Keep that date in mind because the nation and the world will be protesting against this kind of insanity on April 29th. April 29th is a big day. So, we're getting up to the top of the hour, and I'm going to wrap up on time for once. That means it's time for you to stay tuned for Chico Mismo and more of the incomparable Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland.
And this is the Thursday Morning Radio Zine for February 16th, 2006. Coming up next, Carlos Chavez will host Chicanismo. This is a pilot for the new program with guest Ramon Ramirez, president of PACUN, to talk about immigration legislation and a new report that was released on Tuesday, titled, In Our Own Words, Immigrants' Experiences in the Northwest. We'll also have an interview with film producer Moctezuma Esparza. Stay tuned for that. It's coming up next here on the Radio Zine.